It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 225, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, CrowdStrike. Can laptops change? And would you like a third thumb?
Hey there, Gary. How's it going?
Oh, pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Had an interesting week. I'll talk about that towards a little later, but I spent a little time diving into hardware. Speaking of interesting weeks, though.
A very interesting week, at least on your end.
I'll take that. So we're talking about CrowdStrike, of course, and the fact that so many systems were affected by the CrowdStrike problem. And in fact, as we record this on Tuesday afternoon, apparently some are still recovering from it, including Delta Airlines, which I'm sure glad I'm not flying right now. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
So my first thought on it, of course, is so much finger pointing. Everybody's pointing a finger at various places. And in a lot of ways, all of the people that the fingers are being pointed at share some of the blame. But I'm thinking that CrowdStrike gets the gold medal for actually ultimately causing the problem. So what was the problem? So CrowdStrike supplies security software. How to put it? It's basically, you know, your anti-malware software, et cetera, on steroids. Their tool is generally used by large enterprises. So it handles a lot of the aspects of managing a huge organization in some way and keeping it secure. So that's, and right away, that's the good news for the average computer user. We're not using CrowdStrike at all. It's just not something that affects our computers, even though it might be affecting our ability to make an airline reservation.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, if CrowdStrike was something that a typical Windows user would use, or it's just strictly enterprise level stuff.
Yeah, thankfully it's enterprise. It really is. Well, thankfully, I mean, not if you're the enterprise, I suppose. So what they did, I mean, it's really a classic case of pushing an update to their software that had a bug. And, you know, certainly Windows users are familiar with that scenario. It hasn't been that bad in recent years, but certainly in the original Windows 7, Windows 10 kind of timeframes, Microsoft was almost noteworthy for doing that, having Windows Update deliver something to your machine that then caused it to have problems. The issue here, the reason that it was blue screening, is that the software that was updated was software that operates at the device driver level. It's at the lowest level of the machine, meaning that it has the most ability to do things. It can see the most, which is basically something you probably want out of your security software, at least at that level. But that also means it's at the greatest risk, right? If you get it wrong, you get it really, really wrong. So when there's this kind of a failure, I believe it turned out to be a null pointer. They just tried to access an invalid address in memory. When that happens in a driver, Windows doesn't know what to do. There is no definition of what should happen if that happens. So it basically just throws up its hands, gives you the blue screen and says, okay, yep, something happened. Here's a little bit of information on it. And now I'm going to reboot. So far, so good. And again, when we've run into this in the past, it's a simple case of pushing a new update. The issue gets resolved usually very quickly, and life goes on. Unfortunately, and the reason that this is such a huge deal right now is that after the blue screen, when it reboots, it happens again and again. And again, so you're basically in a reboot loop. Okay, fair enough. If you're sitting at your computer and that's happening, you stop it, you boot from a recovery disk of some sort. But again, this is the enterprise. So most of the machines that are affected are being accessed remotely, which means that the remote access component doesn't have a chance to get set up before this problem happens and the machine reboots. What that means, and why this is such a huge problem, is that now the IT departments of all these enterprise customers are having to physically go to each of the machines that are affected and apply the remediation, which is basically an updated driver. When you think about it, a company like Delta or any of the others that have been affected, they've got huge numbers of servers, right? Huge numbers of machines. I suspect that they don't have huge numbers of technicians that are, able to run out and apply this. So that's what's taking so long. It's one of those things where, you can't do it remotely. We all have to take a bus down to the data center and one by one reboot, refix, and restart these machines. Some companies, were able to do it quickly. Probably the right combination of, they didn't have that many machines, or they had, an excess of IT staff, or enough people that could deal with the problem. Others like Delta, that's an issue. That's a big issue. The interesting thing when I talk about the finger pointing, like I said, the real problem here was that CrowdStrike pushed an update that had a bug. What I have heard, I don't have confirmation on this, but what I have heard is that they actually bypassed some quality control in order to push this fix more quickly. Quality control that, in theory, would have prevented this from happening. Why they were trying to push this quickly, I don't know. But that's a classic case of, testing something before you ship it, especially when it's, a critical piece of software, is probably a good thing and worth the extra day or two or whatever it is to get the thing to get the thing tested. Now, Microsoft is getting some blame as well. I mean, of course, it was Windows crashing. It's a Windows blue screen that we saw all over the airports at all the various places. So Microsoft, I suppose, gets a little bit of the blame here for having an architecture where this can happen. That's really the only way I can characterize it from Microsoft's point, the fact that they have this architecture where untrusted third parties are, well, theoretically trusted, but ultimately untrusted third parties are able to push software into their systems at the lowest level. You won't find something like this happening on a Mac because Apple owns the ecosystem from top to bottom. So on one hand, maybe Microsoft should have been able to have some kind of a design for this scenario that wouldn't have been as catastrophic. I don't know. It's a difficult problem from a technical standpoint on how do you deal with, the unknown happening, and how do you prevent it from happening again on a reboot? So Microsoft gets a little bit of blame, fine. But of course, they were the visible poster child for this problem, like I said, because it was the Microsoft blue screen everybody saw. Now, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was, and I can't find the reference, but somebody said that actually it's the EU, the European Union, that caused this problem because they forced Microsoft to open some of their doors for to competition. And in a lot of ways, having third-party security software on Windows machines is, in fact, the competition that they opened the door to. So in a sense, the EU said this needed to happen. Microsoft allowed it to happen, and CrowdStrike made it happen. So that's kind of sort of the whole story behind the thing. I feel bad for the IT folks that are running around with their hair on fire because this was a big one. As many have pointed out, it does indicate just how, I'm reluctant to say fragile, but how reliant we are on so many embedded systems, so many widely adopted systems. I mean, on one hand, it would be nice if everything were independent, but then rather than having, I don't know, half a dozen really good security software, for example, we'd have hundreds of less than secure, less than good, each with their own set of unique problems. So I don't know that lamenting the fact that everybody's using, large swaths of enterprise are using the same tool is really a valid response to this. But it definitely points out, the fragility, the risk, the confidence that we're trying to put in the systems that we use every day.
Do you think, I don't know if you heard anything about, like, that you said they skipped some quality assurance, but they couldn't have skipped all quality assurance. They must have at least tested it on one machine before they sent out. So, I don't
I
know if
really
it's
think
been,
so.
it's, I mean, so was it the kind of thing where they could figure out why the machines they didn't test it, they tested it on, didn't have the problem, but it seemed like this was the kind of thing. Once it went out, all of the machines that got it died. I mean, I haven't really heard whether it was a certain percentage or whatever. So I don't know if you've heard anything about that. I did hear something about something called Microsoft, or I don't know if it's Microsoft, but Azure. What is that? What as a
Azure is
Microsoft?
Microsoft's equivalent to Amazon Web Services. Azure is,
Oh, okay.
online services, storage, PCs, all the stuff that rather than having your own data center, you can outsource to somebody else. So
Ah.
just like Ask Leo is hosted on a server at Amazon Web Services, I could just as easily have hosted it on a server in Azure.
Was that involved in this at all? Because
I
the
think
name
only
came
to
up.
the extent that a number of these enterprises are in fact hosted in Azure. But
Oh,
I've
okay.
also heard that things like AWS, where a lot of these servers are as well, was also impacted with the what was it? I don't remember, but there was some surge of activity surrounding this problem that actually was detectable both at AWS and I'm sure at Azure.
So I wonder if it's the kind of thing where some of Microsoft's, or maybe not even Microsoft's, but somebody else's Azure servers, they crashed because of this. And a client system at a company was simply just unable to do its work, even though it didn't crash.
Yes, absolutely. That's
So
very, very likely. Yep.
I mean, because technically it's like, I didn't try to, I should have tried to do this, but some of the systems that were down, it's like, well, me on a Mac, if I tried to make a reservation at an airline that was supposedly down, I assume I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Correct.
And so then, it doesn't make a difference if I was on Windows or Mac, something was not working for me.
Correct.
Okay, so that's kind of answers that question for me. I would really like to know at some point. Because when I push a software update, say for like my Clip Tools app or something, I test it. It seems to work fine for me. I put it out there. I find maybe if there's a bug, the thing I need to figure out is why is the bug happening for some people and not for me?
Sure.
Or, so then I figure out, oh, it's because they're using an older version of the operating system. This happened to be like a year ago where there was this technical issue with the little help tips that only appeared on certain versions of the operating system and all of that. But it explains why I sent it out because it worked perfectly fine on anything I tested it on.
Right,
So the
right.
thing I'm curious to know is like, yeah, did this really like they tested it and it worked fine in the 10 computers they tested it on, and then they sent it out, and then did it just kill all the computers out there because there was some big difference between their testing computers and the real world, or did it actually work fine on a lot of computers?
Right. Yeah, we don't know. It's interesting. I suspect that we will learn a lot more in the coming weeks. What I find interesting is that CrowdStrike has been called to the principal's office. By that, I mean that apparently Congress wants to talk to them
Oh yeah, I
about
can
why this
imagine.
happened.
I mean, you
So,
ground most of the airplanes in the country, and somebody's going to want to talk to you.
yeah, this is true. So while I don't expect a lot of technical information to be shared with our government representatives in a hearing, I do expect there to be at various levels, both in the trade press and elsewhere, that we will end up learning some more of these details about exactly why this problem had the characteristics it did.
It's it was an interesting thing, and just to see, in some ways to see how fragile things were. But I don't know, there's a lot of headlines that made it seem like, everything had stopped. Whereas if I had simply just decided I wasn't going to pay attention to the news, on Friday, I may have gotten to today and not even known about it,
Exactly. Same here. Yeah.
So it's kind of like it did bring a lot of things down, but at the same time, it really didn't. It does make you also, I was thinking, well, don't the airlines, I mean, running such important enterprises and all that, don't they have any backup plan? And I tried to think of what would that even look like? Like, surely they can't run a completely different computer system with all their databases and all of that in parallel,
In parallel,
just
yeah.
waiting for the day when there's an outage like this, and then expect to be able to just flip a switch and say, oh yeah, we had all these Macs here just running a parallel system that nobody was using, and now we could do it. I don't know. It also made me think of, like, what did they do in the 1960s? Like, would if you wanted to go and fly Pan Am in 1962, you probably called up a travel agent or Pan Am
Yep.
and made a reservation, or you went to a ticketing counter or place or the airport, bought a ticket, and would have been a paper ticket. I mean, there wouldn't have been a database or a computer for them to look up your record of that ticket. Somebody would have written it down on a piece of paper or typed it, like, on their end, right? I don't know. I wonder, we forget how these systems, like, used to work.
Right.
I assume in Pan Am's was in New York, and I assume that at some point, if you bought a ticket, pretty quickly, somebody in New York had a piece of paper that had your name and the flight number on it. And if somebody in Chicago had called New York and said, I want to confirm that so and so has a is on this flight, they could have looked at that piece of paper and told you. It was like human computing or human networking.
Of course, in between that scenario and today, was the era of big iron, right? Mainframes. Many of the airline ticketing, scheduling, reservation systems ran on, and maybe some still do, on mainframe computers, big computers, where rather than having, a bunch of servers that could, all fail because you pushed a bad update, now you have one computer that could fail because you pushed a bad update. But then, of course, I mean, these were data centers where people were working physically. There weren't wasn't a remote access kind of scenario. It was usually pretty clear and pretty quick to fix. What I found hilarious was the supposed reason that Southwest Airline was not impacted by this. Apparently, they're still running their equivalent systems, I guess, on Windows 3.1, which just is jaw-dropping to me because that's not even, even the beginnings of a secure operating system, right? That's basically glorified MS-DOS. They used it to their advantage, and I think they poked some fun at the world on social media while they were at it.
That's a little, I mean, in a way, it's kind of terrifying. I mean, I realize the planes aren't being flown by Windows 3.1. It's just probably their ticketing system, right?
Yeah,
Just
and it's funny because you and I have both made the comment, I've probably made it more often than you, that there are days I'm surprised anything works at all. And that is in part it's cynicism, but in part it's because I understand the magnitude of complexity behind all of these systems and how difficult it is to get things to work and how easy it can be for things to break. This is just one example of, one bad pointer can ruin a lot of people's days. You're right. Hopefully more mission critical, life critical software is held to a somewhat higher standard.
Cool. Yeah, you dropped out there for a second, or I might have dropped out. I don't know. So hopefully It sounds okay in the
Well,
recording.
we got recordings at both ends, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Yeah, no, it's just it's interesting, and yeah, I mean, people have to remember. I mean, there's these systems can fail very easily with something as simple as this, but there's also a certain amount of robustness. Like the entire internet, the reason it works is because of how packets can fly around, and it
Yes.
doesn't just say get from like me to you. This is the route, and that's it. If something is down, it's out, right? It can go lots of different ways. And in fact, it will go lots of different ways all the time without us even knowing that maybe one server or router or cable somewhere isn't working for that minute, which is,
That
may just,
dropout you just experienced could just as easily have been a packet that decided to go the other way around the planet to get here.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of robustness in this and in a lot of the software we use every day. As a software engineer, I know there's a lot of stuff. Like you build systems where you say somebody, you ask somebody to enter a number, and you when they're typing, you only let them enter digits. But also when they press return, you check to make sure that's a valid number. And then when that number is then sent off to be processed in the app, there could be yet another check to make sure that number is a valid number before it goes any further. So you end up with a something breaks in one of those pieces, and the system is robust enough to withstand it.
And
And yes,
yet, I mean, what you've just described is a numerical version of a SQL injection. Basically, when people type their name into a field, which is going to accept, all sorts of characters, if on some systems, if they type in a SQL instruction or a part of a SQL instruction formatted in just the right way, they can cause all kind of havoc. And that's because the software that's handling that was not doing the kind of checks that you just described. They weren't making sure that there wasn't hidden SQL syntax in the input field, or they weren't processing it so that the result would be ever be interpreted as actual MySQL. So you get the idea. I mean, yes, there's a lot of things we do to try and reduce this kind of stuff, but there's still a lot of things that can go wrong.
Indeed. So hopefully by this time next week, it'll all be in the past, and maybe things will be more robust because of this problem.
I hope so.
So yeah, indeed. So I've been thinking a lot about laptops, because there's been a couple news stories about some design changes to some ideas for future laptops, and it got me curious because laptops are kind of really old technology at this point. I was trying to figure out like when the first real laptop was, and the earliest one that I could think of that fits the definition was the TRS-80 Model 100, which is 1983. A
Right.
true, like you can put it in your briefcase, you can put it in your backpack, you could put it on your lap and type.
That was
That,
when I started at Microsoft,
yeah.
and there was a guy down the hall who was working on Microsoft Basic for the Model 100.
Yep. It's a really neat machine. I really wanted one bad back then. One of these days I'm going to go onto eBay and just buy one just to play with it. But things moved really slowly because that was a kind of limiting machine. It had its own little operating system and it was a very small screen. Toshiba came out with one in 1985 that was a DOS that ran DOS. So that was kind of interesting because it was the first one I think that actually just said, "Hey, here's the same thing that's on a desktop, but we put it in a laptop format." So it had an LCD screen that ran DOS, but it was still kind of bulky and still, I mean, it was just running DOS and all that. So it wasn't quite what we have today. Apple came out with its PowerBook 100 in 1991. They had a portable before that, but that was truly just a set it up on the desk portable, not, in your lap. But Apple's PowerBook 100 in 91 has a direct line all the way to today's laptops from Apple. The MacBooks today, and you can go every year after year, and see all the improvements from the PowerBook 100 to today's MacBooks. So, but essentially, since that first PowerBook, and even since that Toshiba, and certainly in the 90s was dominated. The mid 90s got, everybody started coming out with these laptops, and they became extremely popular and have not lost their popularity. But they haven't changed much. The bottom is all of the stuff, the CPU, the memory, the battery, drive, and a keyboard sitting on top of it with a pointing device. And the top part is a screen, a flat screen of some kind, LCD, LED, and all that. And it's basically the same. They're a lot thinner now. They're a lot more powerful now, but the design is essentially the same. However, that might finally be about to change for the first time in, well, 30 years, because there's a couple of things that are kind of like thrown out there as like new models that might be coming out. The first article I want to talk about is actually about Apple maybe thinking about coming out with a MacBook that the bottom half doesn't have a keyboard, a physical keyboard, but has a touchscreen on it. And I've been talking about this for a long time, but more than a decade, because when the iPhone first came out, one of the things that reviewers, kind of put as a negative was that you actually had a keyboard on the touchscreen. And there were a lot of like smartphones then, or feature phones that had physical little keyboards, like the Sidekick and BlackBerry and all of those. And the idea that having a keyboard on the screen that was just a smooth, flat surface and there was no tactile kind of feeling to it, it got a negative reaction at first, except that users just didn't care. Users just bought the iPhone and started typing on it, and some people adding, really fast speeds. And then, of course, Android phones came out, and it quickly became the standard. Plus, of course, tablets came out soon after, and those also had these virtual touchscreens and all that. And there are definitely people that are like, no, never, I need a physical keyboard. But there are also a lot of people that quietly don't say anything and just actually use those virtual keyboards all the time. And there's tactile feedback now because you actually have like haptic feedback on a lot of these, where you can kind of feel like you're typing. There does feel like there's a physical reaction to hitting the keys. So yeah, I think I've always thought it would be interesting to have a laptop that the screen, there was a bottom screen that had a virtual keyboard on it, because yes, you wouldn't have the physical keys, but I think a lot of people wouldn't care because not everybody's writing novels or like coding all day, right? A lot of people just use their computers to browse around, to type emails and messages, things like that. Having a touch screen instead of a physical keyboard allows you, first of all, to switch keyboards, right? You could switch languages. I mean, you don't have to get anything physically new. You could just tap a button or change a setting, and now it's a French keyboard or a Japanese keyboard or whatever. Or even versions of the keyboard for your language, but maybe for different uses. One that's more for editing with cut, copy, and paste buttons and all sorts of things. One that's more for design. You could also have specialty keyboards for like working in graphics apps and such, that have lots of controls that work like trackpads and such, as well as a keyboard. Some people may want a small keyboard with lots of controls around it. Some people may want to have the keys be as large as possible. You could do all that with a virtual keyboard, which gives it a big advantage over a physical keyboard that can't really change at all. Plus, think of the keyboard shortcuts that could be highlighted on there. Even the reactions. I mean, sure, a physical keyboard gives you the feeling that you're pushing down, but a virtual keyboard can actually change the color of the key as you press it, which is exactly what happens on phones and tablets, actually. So there's a lot of different things that can happen with it. And rumors are that Apple may be thinking about this. The article I'm going to link to is from 9to5 Mac, and there's an interesting line there that I thought in that article that I thought they missed the mark on it, because they said that Macs don't have a touchscreen interface. So in order for this rumor to be true, there would need to be a change to macOS to allow a touchscreen interface. But I don't think so. I think you could still have the top screen with no touchscreen at all, and the bottom screen actually never showing the macOS interface, but only being a virtual control, like a keyboard or specialty board, kind of like the touch bar was for
That seems like a
X for Y.
huge missed opportunity. And I say that because, you're talking about all the different keyboards you can have. And yes, that's nice. But I keep thinking about, okay, it's a screen. Why not use it for your application when your application doesn't rely on a keyboard?
Yeah, you could. You could, but the thing is that you don't have to change everything to have this. You could basically have this be a touchscreen keyboard thing. I mean, certainly if you had touchscreen on the bottom and non-touchscreen on the top, then you could do things like, say, a graphics editor could allow you to move the image down to the bottom where you can actually draw on it with a stylus or with your finger and then move it back to the top. But my point is that the whole macOS doesn't need to change just to have a virtual keyboard. It can be like it can be met halfway. And plus, I think the haptics would be really interesting. Like right now, of course, you've got haptics on an iPhone. You also have haptics on a trackpad where you feel as if you're clicking when in fact the trackpad is not mechanical. It doesn't move. But yet,
I have that
if
on my laptop, and
you
it's the weirdest thing.
it is, but now imagine if the haptics actually existed in two dimensions where there were different haptic points along the keyboard, not one for every key, but just maybe, I don't know, 4 points, 8 points, something like that. And when you tap, it actually gives you the feedback based on how close the points are to that key,
Oh,
making
sure.
it feel like you've actually pressed a key. Like if you have another finger resting on another part of the touchscreen, that finger wouldn't feel it as much as the finger actually pressing the key. I don't know. There's a lot of interesting things they could do. And of course, there's the height of a keyboard, even a very thin keyboard like Apple does. It's not going to be as thin as a screen, right? That could be super thin. So you can make these things even thinner. You still can go ahead and have a physical keyboard. It's a somebody could still go and get one and attach it to it, just like they do with iPads now. But anyway, I think it's interesting that there's another rumor that Apple might be thinking about this. And I, for one, would love to have a machine like this. Even though I do occasionally type things, because I've been known to write a book or two, and I do code, I could very easily see, like, oh, when I travel, I'm not typing large amounts of text. Just give me, I'll just have the virtual keyboard. When I'm home, I might have a Bluetooth keyboard hooked up to it, so I can go and use it for typing. But that's not the only design that's kind of interesting. Another company, let me get the name of this company. It's called Spacetop, or that's the name of the actual product, I think. And it's from Siteful. So this isn't out yet, but there was an article here on in PC World about it. And it's a laptop where the bottom looks like a normal laptop. It's got physical keyboard. So it's the opposite here. The keyboard's the same. The bottom is actually the same. There's no screen though. Instead of a screen, you've got a pair of AR glasses, very much like the Apple Vision Pro. And the funny thing is that's how people, including me sometimes, are actually using their Macs now. When I'm editing in particular and doing some other tasks as well, my screens are off because I've got the Apple Vision Pro on and I'm using a virtual screen. So technically, I haven't really done this. I haven't traveled with my MacBook Air, but I could and actually not use the MacBook Air screen at all. Matter of fact, if I had a version of the MacBook Air that had no screen, I could just use the Apple Vision Pro as the display. This product is basically that. The top cover actually just hides some glasses. You open it up and you put the glasses on, and then you see a virtual display, or actually a number of virtual windows. And this is a Windows product, not a Mac product. So, and you would see this big screen in front of you, and the glasses are the display rather than an actual physical display. It's got some interesting advantages. One is you can have a much larger screen that you could ever have with a laptop. Another is it's completely private. Nobody else could see it except you, which is useful. I've used my laptop on airplanes before when I've grown self-conscious that I wonder if anybody's looking at what I'm doing. I'm coding or I'm writing a document or I'm editing a video. Who knows what, whatever, playing a silly game, and other people can see me. And just as if to verify that that's true, when I see somebody else using a laptop on the plane, and if they're in my line of sight, It's next to impossible for me to resist actually trying to figure out what it is that they're doing. You know, if I mean, if they've got a spreadsheet open and they're like
Exactly.
two rows in front of me, just, you know, in across the aisle, it's like it is my goal now to figure out what the spreadsheet is about, even if it's the most boring, like financial, you know, junk from, you know, some sort of like meeting or something like that. It's like I'm kind of squinting every chance I can get just to see. So anyway, this is private, and it's an interesting concept. It's really interesting because the Apple Vision Pro proves the concept. It actually works. You can do it now. It will just cost a lot and probably weigh a lot more than you want, right? Because the Apple Vision Pro does a lot of things not necessary for this. Sightful spacetop laptop just does the virtual screen part, which is just one function of the Vision Pro. But I mean, why not have that as a function? Like, I would love to get a version of it, since I use my Vision Pro 90% of the time just for this. And I would love to have one that was half the price or even less that just did that and replace my laptop screen. So that's an interesting concept too. And yeah, I kind of feel like these things are, there's a lot of this going around now, and I think there's some pressure maybe to break out of the 30-year-old model. There are things that do, like just trying to really think about it, I noticed that, first of all, Lenovo does have a laptop, a version of their Yoga book that is virtual screen at the bottom. And it's an interesting product. I haven't seen it in person, but I looked at the website. First thing is you can do a virtual keyboard, but they also have a Bluetooth keyboard that is designed to sit on top of the screen.
No, I didn't know
So
that.
you bring that keyboard out, you stick it on top, and you still have part of the virtual bot or part of the bottom keyboard visible above it or below it. I'm not sure. So it's an interesting little product there. There's also the whole, you know, Microsoft has actually had something kind of in, you know, planned called the Microsoft Surface Neo, which is
Yeah,
this.
I had to look it up, and my guess is that that is a dream that will never happen because they came up with it. They announced it 5 years ago, and there's been nothing on it ever since.
Nothing, but yet it's kind of, so the Surface, it, trying to straddle the world between tablet and laptop, actually kind of, I mean, you can use a virtual keyboard on a Surface. Of course, when you do it, you kind of feel like you're using an iPad, but it's the same. The iPad's coming the other direction. That, like, the default thing for the iPad is to not have a keyboard and to be using a virtual keyboard. And then you can get the keyboard from Apple, the Magic Keyboard, that has the trackpad and everything in it. And a lot of people just do that as the default. They get the iPad, they get the Magic Keyboard from Apple, and they use it as a laptop replacement. And they can take off the keyboard and then use a virtual keyboard. So you're kind of, you've got two products, the Surface and the iPad, that are approaching it kind of from opposite directions, but meet in the middle with a lot of crossover there. And there is kind of this happening. Like, it's just to the point now where it's not like a full Windows 11 laptop that's got this, you know, until, you know, except for the Yoga book, and you don't have an Apple, like a true Mac OS product that has a virtual keyboard like this. It just, things are getting closer. So, and with the Apple Vision Pro or this Sightful product, it just feels like the time is like ripe that maybe we'll start to see something new and laptops will finally change.
I tend to agree, although I will say that I suspect that Microsoft is investing not so much in this kind of design stuff. They've jumped off the AI cliff. If you take a look at their more recent Surface announcements, it's all been of it has been around AI in the machine. We've talked about some aspects of it in the past. So I suspect that when it comes to their investments and the kinds of things that we can see from them in the near term, it's not going to be, novel or unique kind of keyboards or virtual keyboards or virtual screens. It's going to be, Copilot.
AI does help with the typing. I mean, typing something that has gone from basic voice recognition dictation to getting smarter and smarter. to now, you know, AI starting to really dig into it. And the thing that really helps is, you know, it's becoming more like Star Trek, basically, where we don't have to, pretty soon, we don't really need to worry about the accuracy of the voice recognition because the AI will be listening to us and being like, no, that can't be what you said. That's ridiculous. You know what you probably said is this.
I never
And
ever mean duck.
yeah, exactly. And I see this actually already with like Apple stuff. I mean, it was only a few years ago that Apple's dictation built into Mac OS was strictly like voice recognition. If you spoke a word and the word appeared on the screen wrong, it was not going to change, right? You had to stop and change it. Now you can actually talk, and a word at the beginning of a sentence will actually change. If when you get to the end of the sentence, it's obvious that, okay, that couldn't have been what you meant at the beginning because this is where the sentence went. And you could see that word, you know, get underlined and change at the beginning. I've even done, just the other day, I did this where I was dictating a long sentence and it got the first word wrong. And I was like, you know, I'm thinking in my head as I'm talking, have faith, have faith. And I got to the end of the sentence, I finished the sentence, and I thought, oh, it didn't get it. And then I saw the word change. I was
Very
like, oh,
cool.
it did get it. That's really cool.
It
And
is pretty amazing what dictation has turned into of late. I know that it's the pr my
yeah.
primary method of getting things into my phone, of any length, just because it is so much easier than trying to, use my fat fingers on those little keyboards.
Yeah. And the only real disadvantage for most people is the thing that, you know, you kind of need to be alone in a room. You know, you can't, and it's not so much, I mean, if you're working in like a cubicle or you're in a coffee shop or whatever, you can't just be talking, but you kind of can. I mean, like if you walk into a coffee shop and somebody's talking on the phone at a reasonable volume, that's not unusual.
We have a
So,
friend who started doing this, and what she does is actually probably the most appropriate approach of all, even for crowded situations. She will hold the phone up to her mouth and speak very low volume to it.
yeah.
So it kind of sounds like she's whispering, and it works really, really well for her.
Well, you know, add the voice isolation stuff that I'm using now for my show. I've been using it for months now, maybe 6 months for my show, where, you know, I went from having to put all these panels up all around my office to cut out the reverb. I turn off the AC while I'm recording because the noise it makes. If there's a loud car or truck or a siren goes by, then that kills whatever it is I just said or whatever. Now with voice isolation, none of that matters. Like I have the AC on at a fire truck can go by blaring, and I just keep going, and I run it through the Adobe's Podcast Enhance, and you cannot tell any of that stuff. And there are other ones that are competing. Matter of fact, I just tried out 11 Labs has a voice isolation thing, part of their suite, and that works just as well. So
I
you
did
could
this with DaVinci Resolve not that long ago. Somebody for the nonprofit that I volunteer for, they had recorded a how-to video about something, and they live underneath the approach to one of our local airports. And I don't mean just, like I live under the approach to SeaTac, but it's like 10 miles away. No, they were like a half a mile from the runway. And I thought, oh man, this is going to be bad. And it was, the original was bad. But I ran it through DaVinci Resolve, and it turns out they have this same thing, voice isolation. And it was awesome. It just did a wonderful job at really recovering the audio.
Yeah, and imagine adding that into the dictation with AI and all that stuff and not having to hold the phone like right in front of your face, but actually it knowing your voice a little bit or figuring out that you were the constant voice talking and being able to grab your voice like that. It's just maybe the future of the keyboard isn't the virtual screen keyboard, but maybe we just move more and more towards dictation. I certainly wouldn't mind while traveling having that option, you know, leave the keyboard behind. If I really need to write a long email while I'm on vacation, you know, I could find a quieter spot if I need to, or a spot where I'm not going to look rude and do it. So I don't know. There's a lot of technology that I think my point to this whole thing is there's a lot of technology pointing towards laptops, yet as of right now, laptops are the same they have been for 30 years. That can't
Definitely.
stand, right? Either dictation or touch screens or AR glasses, something is going to push, and the design of laptops will change sometime in the next few years and finally be different than they were in the mid 90s.
You know what you need for that? Another thumb.
Well, this was another neat thing I've been meaning to bring up for a while. I don't know if you caught this article that it's yeah. So this article was in Popular Science, right? Popular Science, and it's this idea that some scientists came up with, engineers, I guess, to create a thumb that it's a mechanical thumb, so a prosthetic. But it's not replacing your current thumb, like for somebody that might be missing theirs. It's actually going in the other side of your hand. So to give you a sixth finger, basically a thumb on the other side of your hand. And it's a really actually simple device. It's just basically some joints with a string that could be pulled in and out. So basically the thumb could be bent in and then released. And you control it with a little controller that attaches to some toes on your foot.
Oh, really?
So there's no special weird hookups or anything like that. It's very simple, not very expensive thing to actually put together. And you attach it, you strap it onto your wrist, kind of, and then it puts a thumb like on the other side. So your hand suddenly becomes kind of symmetrical. And you just practice a little bit with like one or two toes pressing. And then the thumb, just this sixth finger or thumb closes. So it's really easy to use. And they tested it out with a whole bunch of people. And it turns out it's very intuitive. Like our brains kind of get it pretty quickly how to go and use this thing. And there are a ton of different uses for it. Like you can grasp a lot more and do a lot more things. Like one of the things we can't do with one hand usually is hold a bottle and open it. That's a two-handed job, right? Opening things usually like top and bottom, you have to hold in one hand, open with the other. But when you have an extra thumb, you can actually do those with one hand. So it allows for all sorts of interesting tasks to be done. And they found that people readily adapted to this, just trying it for a few days, which, the whole idea of prosthetics, is interesting in terms of like getting somebody who has a disability kind of to be able to do the things that people without the disability can do. But then to actually take it a step further and have something like this where you can get somebody who is fully abled, but you can add an extra, thumb and now do extra things. And thinking of like what kind of things could you do if like in your work, in arts and crafts or some sort of skilled job, having a extra abled hand where you've got a sixth finger on the other side. It's a really neat thing, and they have some videos at the article that we'll link to, showing people using it, from like kids using it to seniors using it. It's
Interesting.
a really interesting idea.
It's the other end of the spectrum from an exoskeleton, right? It's just this one additional digit.
It's just a very it's like a very simple concept in the same realm as an exoskeleton. Instead of making something stronger, like an exoskeleton on your arm, giving you extra strength in your arm, this is just adding a little extra thing. So, it's a cool idea. I love ideas like this. And I imagine that if something like this catches on, it probably won't catch on for the general public as like a general thing, but it'll turn out that like I don't know, auto mechanics.
Certain
Or
jobs, yeah.
people that work like a specific kind of machine and in factories or whatever, like it becomes this thing where now they could do that job so much easier with this simple little extra device. So,
Very cool. So I did want to quickly mention that I've been having some hardware adventures. I'm concerned. I've had two failures in the last week, and I'm waiting for the third one because these things seem to happen in threes. I had the main hard disk of my Linux computer, which is a basically a server I use down in the basement for backing up and a few other things. It just died, just up and died. Was one of those things where I pulled the hard disk out and I couldn't recover anything from it, which is fine. All it really had was the operating system. So I ended up, just replacing it with one of the spare drives I have lying around anyway. As my systems have increased in capacity, I'll replace a 1 terabyte drive with an 8 terabyte drive and just sort of set the 1 terabyte drive aside. This is what the 1 terabyte is perfect for, right? Just be the hard disk for my Linux box. So that happened. And then I've had for the first time, I think ever, I actually had a RAM module go bad. And when I say ever, I mean ever, like in 40 years or plus in the industry. My machine here, the desktop that I'm using right now, would occasionally blue screen. And I was, trying to do the usual diagnostic to see, okay, is there any consistency? What's going on? There was no consistency. So kind of on a whim, I ran a memory test, Memtest 86, I think it's called, which is something you boot from and it just pounds the memory for a while. And sure enough, it gave up because there were too many errors in one of the modules. I said, well, that's special. This machine had 64 gigabytes in it. It now has 32 gigabytes in it because all I really needed to do was remove the offending module, and the 32 is plenty to keep the machine running for sure. And I ordered 128 gigabytes. I figure if I'm going to replace the RAM, I'm going to supersize it. And put in max capacity, which I usually do with machines that I've had for a few years. So yeah, in my hands right now, I have four DDR4 64 gigabytes, or actually 32 gigabyte memory cards that after our recording is done, I'll be shutting down my machine and doing the upgrade. We'll Like I said, and I'm a little nervous about what the third failure will be, but we shall see. It's how to put it. It's good to be a geek. I've said that many times before, but it is definitely good to, just have skills, the intuition, whatever the hell you want to call it, of saying, you know what? I wonder if it could be this, and then having it turn out to be that. So
Interesting.
that was cool. Speaking of
Yeah.
cool, ain't it cool?
Speaking, yeah. What did you find cool this week?
Orphan Black Echoes. Did you ever watch Orphan Black?
No, it is definitely on my to get around to it one day
It's
list.
funny. Years ago when it was out, I watched like one half of the first episode while I was exercising. I was on my elliptical, I think. And I realized that nope, I cannot watch the rest of this because my wife will be very interested in it.
Oh,
And
okay.
we got glued to it. We watched the whole thing, and it was a very good series. Tatiana Maslany is the primary in that series, and she's an awesome actress. I mean, just the kinds of things, the kind of hoops that she ends up having to jump through playing different characters, very different characters. That's pretty amazing. Anyway, she's not in Orphan Black Echoes. Kristen Ritter, who some might know from the Jessica Jones series on Netflix some years ago, is the primary in this one. It includes, the story includes the daughter of the character from Orphan Black and goes through some of the same machinations, different, but still, some very interesting ethical dilemmas about how things are created and such. But we're halfway through it. It has released fully in other countries, but we're actually being slowed down. So we're I think episode 4 or 5 of 8 right now. And I personally am enjoying it quite a bit. It's one of those thought-provoking things that has you asking some questions.
Cool. I'm in the middle of a book right now, called The Conquest of the Incas, and it's a history book, as you can guess. But the reason I wanted to bring it up during our show is because the Incas, big empire, that was pretty much completely isolated from the rest of the world for centuries, and then pretty much overnight was discovered and then conquered by the Spanish.
Right.
They had an interesting thing technologically. They had not discovered the wheel. Now, you may think that it's like, wow, the wheel, that's, I mean, they must have been super primitive if they didn't have the wheel. Yet they were not. They had pretty advanced agriculture, very advanced building techniques. They were able to do incredible stuff with stonework. They had metalworking. They had built bridges that were just incredible suspension bridges. They had an administration for their empire that was really advanced. And they had cities that basically were, in many ways, on par with what was in Europe at the time, yet no wheel. And the reason they didn't have the wheel is because, number one, they had no use for it. And number two, the wheel requires an engine to actually use it. So when you have, in Europe and the rest of the world, when you had animals that could pull
Right.
carts, then the wheel made sense. You didn't have that in South America. You had llamas. They weren't draft animals. They were pack animals. They didn't have an animal that could pull a cart. And they didn't
Interesting.
have roads that made sense. Their roads had to have steps in them because they were going up and down mountains.
Interesting.
So a wheel would not have made sense. So they didn't have the wheel. They missed out on a crucial piece of technology because simply they didn't need it, and they didn't have the thing that we forget goes along with the wheel,
Right.
the engine. And it made me think, like, what technology are we missing now because of something similar, like some sort of thing that would change the world, but because there's a piece missing, just as the Incas had the whole, like, their terrain and not having draft animals, they were missing those things. Just made it, oh, they didn't have it. Just never occurred to them. So, yeah, kind of interesting to think about that. And there's, of course, a lot of other technology things in there about they didn't have a system of writing either, yet they had advanced administration for the empire. So kind of interesting stuff. So anyway, if you like history, check out that book.
In terms of blatant self-promotion, the article I want to point people at this week is Should I Switch to Linux? It's funny. It's askleo.com/3222. It's funny I say that because one of the very common responses I get specifically to YouTube videos is, I'll be talking about how to work around some problem with Windows. Right now, one of my more popular videos is, why doesn't Microsoft dump the registry? And I get a lot of people saying, solve the problem, switch to Linux, solve the problem, switch to Linux. And the same thing with OneDrive. And, okay, that actually is a valid answer, just not for everybody. So anyway, I talk through the issues, of what people need to think about if that is something they want to consider.
I'll point to a video called Adding More Keys for More Mac Shortcuts. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but you can get these really cool devices that are basically just a like a it's like a not a keyboard, but it's a bunch of buttons like on a device, and you can hook it up to your computer either by
Right.
USB or Bluetooth, and you can do shortcuts to those buttons. And sometimes there are switches, knobs, and dials, and all this stuff. And people that do video editing or other things like that sometimes have these things. People that produce music do it a lot. But you don't need to get one of those if you just want to add a bunch of extra buttons to your Mac. Like, you can get a $20 little keypad that's just a numeric keypad. And you can just have that, and instead of using it as a keypad like an accountant might to just enter in lots of numbers, you can actually assign keyboard shortcuts specifically to the numbers on that keypad and the little other keys that are there, and then assign them to things that you need. So instead of having to, like, oh, I set up a custom keyboard shortcut, I just got to remember it's shift control and then option and then
Right.
seven. You could actually just have one key on this little keypad and press it and use it. And if you have an extended keyboard that actually has a numeric keypad, then you can actually use that numeric keypad there for these things as well, which is something I do. Every key on my numeric keypad on my extended keyboard actually does multiple things depending upon which app I'm in.
And
Fascinating. I don't have to have this whole like $300 extra device on my desk with all the remembering what each of those buttons do. I just got to remember that five does this and four does that, nine does that. So, yeah.
Cool. That does sound interesting. And yeah, it makes me wonder. I should think about what keys I might want to remap, because I've definitely got a few on the keyboard that I don't use, and definitely some keyboard sequences that that I use frequently that might be replaced with a single button. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for yet another week. As always, thank you for listening, and we will see you here again very soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/teh225. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.